Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Culinary Center, and we are not at Roberta's today. We're not in a container, but we are in a small office above Il Canto in San Francisco with the one and only winner of Master Chefs on Bravo, Chris Constantino. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for, I mean, we just listened to him giving staff background on the menu downstairs, and it was a performance. It was a real performance. I loved it. I can't wait to eat. Anyway, if for you, for the few of you who might not know who Chris is, he's the chef of Il Canto, where he's been for quite a long while, actually. But many of you probably know him because he won Top Chef Masters in last season, 2012, right? And you've seen him on The Next Iron Chef, Iron Chef America, Best Thing I Ever Ate. He's got an incredible website, Awful Good. And that's OFFAL. And he is in 2009. You might have seen him on the Food Network. It was Chef versus City. And he's the author of Beginnings, My Way to Start a Meal. So, Chris, nice to be here.
Thanks for coming.
Okay, so we're in San Francisco, but you're a Rhode Island boy.
Yeah, born and raised.
Born and raised. So tell me a little bit about growing up in Rhode Island. And were you into food? Were you born with a spoon in your mouth? It didn't have to be a silver spoon, but did you love food ever since you started?
Well, you know, growing up in Rhode Island, my mother's family was from Newport. And my father's family was from Providence. Two very different households. So we had, my mother's family was English, my father's family is Italian, so the Cosentinos, and then the Eastons. The Eastons founded Newport, Rhode Island. They landed on First Beach.
How fancy.
Not that fancy. My mother's family started a sausage company called Easton's Newport Breakfast Sausage. It was the first sausage company to ship up and down the eastern seaboard.
Oh.
The company went out of business in World War II due to the fact that the spice trade was cut, and they refused to make an inferior product. So food was always a part of growing up. I grew up in an area of Rhode Island called Portsmouth, which is on Aquidneck Island, and it was potato fields, corn fields, tomato. In the summer, it was commercial fishing, and, you know, I lived literally on the beach. You know, right on the, and it wasn't a sandy beach. It wasn't like Hawaii. It was a rocky beach. We'd go fishing for bluefish and digging for quahogs and old school.
Right. What was your favorite thing to eat when you were a kid?
As a kid, I wouldn't even eat a raw tomato till I was 20.
Are you kidding? Why was that?
Just didn't like the texture.
Was it because they were store-bought?
No, we had gardens. I mean, we had gardens in my yard ever since I was a little kid. My great-grandmother used to grow tomatoes. She used to grow Semerzanos. She smuggled the seeds in from Italy when she came. She moved this country. Rosalie Cosentino. And then we always had gardens in our backyard in Portsmouth. But it was just, it was the texture. I didn't like the texture. I liked cooked carrots. No, excuse me. I liked raw carrots, not cooked carrots. I wouldn't eat tomatoes unless it was sauce because I didn't like the texture of raw tomatoes. So I think it was just childhood palate. You know, just not really. But I would eat quahogs. I would eat stuffed clams. I would eat steamers. I would eat bluefish. I would eat anything out of the water. Never a problem.
What kind of student were you?
I was probably the worst student in the world.
Why?
I barely graduated high school. I have multiple learning disabilities. ADD, ADD, HDD. I don't know what all that crap means. But I'm also dyslexic. So it really created a lot of problems because you don't fit into that school mode that they want you to be in. They always want you to follow their way of learning. It has to be their way or the highway.
Right.
And I really didn't care for the information that they were giving me. It wasn't really of any interest to me. All I wanted to do was ride my skateboard and, you know, go work on the fishing boat with Alan and the Wheelers. I just didn't care. You know, it was not hands-on. I mean, did I do great in, like, hands-on learning? I did great in art. I did great in history because I liked history. And I did great in, like, shop class where I used to make baseball bats and, you know, stuff like that.
Did you work in a restaurant when you were a teenager?
You know, when I was 14 years old, I lied and said I was old enough. Took a dishwashing job at IHOP, International House Pancakes. One of my friend's fathers owned it. And I worked there for the summer because I wanted to go skiing in Europe. So the only way I was allowed to go skiing in Europe was to save my own money and pay for my trip. So I wanted to go skiing in Austria. Had to work all summer. No free rides, you know. Showed up. First day, I had no idea what a full day of work was. I showed up and I thought I was going to be there for a few hours and head out. So, you know, I showed up with my skateboard, ready to go downtown Newport, go skateboarding with my friends. 9 hours later, I got to go home. And it was a pretty big eye-opener because you never really knew that.
Had you stood on your feet for 9 hours like that before?
I had. I mean, I'd worked, even before that, I'd actually apprenticed with an electrician as a younger kid. And I would go to jobs and, you know, pull wire by foot and, you know, get them their tools. And that was kind of my first real job. But in a kitchen, you know, I'd never really expected that. And it ended up becoming a game for me.
And how so?
Well, I used to watch this. There was only two chefs on the line, you know, and it's...
How many covers would they do?
Huge, huge numbers. I mean, I would work morning shifts some days. I would work night shifts. And night shifts are late at IHOP because they stay open until like 2. And usually from midnight till 2 was the drunk show. And you'd be packed. You'd do like 200 covers in there. It's a full-on shit show of like wasted people. But it was amazing to me that two guys could make sure that the pancakes, eggs, and the toast, everything coming up at the same time was all hot. There was something to be said. The art of breakfast is, there's nothing like it. You have to be a great, organized, talented person to be able to execute breakfast, everything coming out hot, everything coming out correct all the time. It's not a joke.
Oh, I know. Even to do it for myself is hard.
But I mean, if you think about it, it was all done on flat tops too.
Yeah.
Everything was on flat tops. And I thought that was just, it was so cool to watch these guys. So then what would end up happening is, there was a young lady who worked in the dining room. And there used to be a game. They used to see who could bury me. It was the joke, like how many bus bins could we hold back, and then just hammer Chris with all the dishes at once and see how long it would take him to get them buried. So it became a game, like can I beat her? And then it became a situation where it became money started getting on the table. I could do this in 30 minutes. I could do this in less than 30 minutes, and it got to a point where I wanted to cook. They didn't want to bust suds anymore. And I would do prep. I would wash potatoes and do all that stuff. But there was not an option there. And then I moved on to Salve Regina College. I think it's a university now.
Why'd you go to college if you didn't like high school?
Well, that's where I took a job. I wasn't going to college.
Oh, all right.
I mean, I was now 16 years old, and I was working in an all-girls school in the cafeteria. It was kind of cool. At least it was an all-girls school. I think they had a couple years before it, you know, co-ed. But I was in the cafeteria working in the cafeteria. So we were cooking for many people, and I was prepping, working salad bar station, prepping all the salad station and stuff. And that was actually, you know, right before I went away to college.
So you went to Johnson & Wales?
I went to Johnson & Wales. I did a four-year program, 2 years of culinary. And then 2 years of food service management.
So for someone who didn't like school, did you love that?
It was a different world.
Yeah, because it was something you loved to do, you know?
Well, it was hands-on. It was a hands-on learning environment. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't... There were wrong ways to do things, mm-hmm. right? But there was... Even though sometimes it may have been the wrong way, you got a different end result. Not that that end result was bad. It was just the way that the school didn't want you to do it.
So right? Give us an example.
Okay. So when you go to Italy, right?
Mm-hmm.
the same dish from five different grandmas is five different things.
Right.
Are any of them wrong?
No.
And if you're going to say they're wrong, I dare you to tell that grandmother that they're wrong.
Right.
Because she'll knock you with a rolling pin or her pasta pin. All right?
Right.
So when you look at it from that perspective, from the Italian style of cooking, each way may come out to be the final, that means, a little bit different. Mm-hmm. It's a different method to get there, but it may end up being the same thing. Just like a pasta shape could have six different names depending on the region that it's from.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
So maloredas or cavatelli. Mm-hmm. Same pasta, different name.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So in French cooking,
mm-hmm.
you buy the book. Right?
Well, you have regional cooking. I mean,
you have La Russe Gastronomique and you stick by the gun. That's the way it was when I went to school.
Oh, well,
we're talking 1990 here.
All right, but you know what? Well, wait, let's get into this a little bit. If you go into a formal restaurant in Italy, let's say you go into Bottura's, you know, kitchen.
Massimo?
Yeah.
But he's a different world.
There's classic technique at that level
of
haute cuisine, and they actually use the French terminology. You're talking trattoria, and of course, that's
I'm talking across cooking. The board. I'm talking across the board. Technique is technique.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Concasse, mondaire.
Right.
Dipoulage, they're all fancy French terms.
Right.
Skim scum. Skim the fat, dude. All right? It's not that hard. Peel the tomato.
Right.
De-seed and dice.
Right.
Okay? Let's break it down in the simplest form. I think, for me, yeah, it was really fun to learn the French terms, which I ended up trying to use to pick up girls when I was in Montreal, which was hysterical.
Let me concasse you.
That's really, I don't think it's...
it
was pretty bad. But, you know, a couple beers and shots in you in Montreal, and you're trying to talk bad kitchen French to pick up girls didn't really work. But it was a learning environment that was open for all different levels of education.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't so set in stone that you couldn't learn.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the public school system is designed in a specific manner that you have to pass the certain tests.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So culinary school is very different.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into the bookwork classes, which are about as much fun as, you know, walking barefoot on hot coals. But, mm-hmm. you know, that's part of the deal. That's what right. you sign up for. Sanitation was really important, so it interested
me. Right. Oh, really? So,
yeah. Well, you have to. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to kill anybody.
Right.
But the English classes were just deplorable. The cat jumped over the dog. A noun, please. That was like a question. I was, you know, where I would have much rather read a book and done a book report.
Like because White it was, Heat, right?
Well, yeah, or like anything. It could have been a book by James Beard. It could have been Raymond Sokolov,
right.
Why We Eat What We Eat.
Right.
But do a book report on a book that's about food.
Right.
But being
all right, well, let's get beyond this. Let's,
it's a different world.
So you graduate from school. Where do you go to work?
During the whole time I was at school, I was working. I was working in different restaurants throughout in Providence.
Providence.
And then I was working at one. I was working at the Seafair Inn in Portsmouth, which is where I'm from. He's here already?
Yes, he is.
Oh, God. Does he need to see me? It's okay.
No, he literally just sat. So.
Okay, I'll be down in a minute. So, I think working in school was really important for me because we had a 3-day weekend, so I worked every weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So I basically was 7 days a week. And even during school, I worked the other half of the day. So I really didn't play. I just worked. And so...
Why was that? Were you wanted the money? You were so into cooking? Or you didn't have anything better to do?
I had plenty of better things to do.
So why? What drove you?
Because I was in a school with thousands of kids, and we weren't the only culinary school. There's all these people spilling out into a market. So how do you get yourself there? How do you get ahead? How do you learn? How do you push yourself? I volunteered for every single event that was available.
Good thing to do.
It was. I mean, it took away a lot of my life, meaning like I didn't go to rock shows, I didn't go to concerts, I didn't go, you know, until maybe when I was finished with culinary school in particular, my first 2 years. Then after that, then I was in the bookwork part. That's when I started enjoying things a little bit more. I worked for the school. I was a teaching assistant and fellow for 2 years. I worked in all their kitchens and working with students, and then took business classes.
Why did you do that? Why did you take a teaching assistant job?
You learn by teaching. You learn by repetition. So as you show people over and over and over again, you're learning. For me, it was really it's really important to learn to work with people, even though they didn't want to work with you. So you're teaching your peers. Nobody wants to hear from somebody that's the same age as you that they're doing something wrong because they think you don't know better.
Right.
So learning the delicate art of explaining, mm-hmm. reprimanding, mm-hmm. and correcting without getting your face punched in after the day's over when you walk outside of the parking lot is a pretty cool task. Because if you can master that, you can do anything. And because we would be put in really awkward situations.
Like one?
Well, I mean, you're managing people, your own peers. So imagine running a restaurant, you're managing a station in a restaurant, a busy restaurant at that, and you have a student with you. But you're responsible for everything they're putting up. Just like the chef is of every restaurant.
Sure.
You're responsible for all your staff. But they may have gone out and partied hard the night before. Mm-hmm. They may be fraternity. They may have had a rough day at home. They may not show up with their proper uniform. And I have to write them up and grade them. Mm-hmm. That doesn't really go over too well. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier to take that kind of information from a teacher. Somebody right. that's older than you. Mm-hmm. But somebody that's the same age, it comes across the wrong way sometimes. Mm-hmm. So it really was a big learning curve for me. But I'm glad I did it.
Okay, well, we're going to take a little break, and we're going to come back and hear about your foray into the work world. Who's this?
Hey, dude! Hey, come here!
Is this your son?
Yes, it is.
Can I take a picture of the two of
you? Come here, buddy. Come on, can I have a hug-oo? You look like you got a little more sunburn today. Did you put any sunscreen on? Yes, can I give a hug-oo?
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Did you know that pollinators are needed for more than two-thirds of the world's crop species? Most of these pollinators are bees. However, North America's bee population has been steadily declining since the 1990s. Whether you live in the country or the city, you can show your commitment by hosting a hive in your backyard or even on a rooftop. The beekeeping movement is growing, so you're sure to find swarms of folks who can help you find your way. Learn more about the ways you can help be the solution at wholefoodsmarket.com/sharethebuzz.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today my guest is Chris Constantino from Il Canto, and we're sitting in San Francisco. So, Chris, we just got you as a teaching assistant, Johnson & Wales, young, having to write up people. So where do you go from there? What was your vision? What did you think you were going to be doing in 5 years?
You know, I really had no idea, but it's funny. The other day, my son busted out my high school yearbook out of the... found it, which was a little awkward to have. He's like, look at that. And in my senior yearbook, I wrote, be an internationally known chef.
Oh, and you are.
Okay.
Grinding the tuna heart.
No, beef heart.
Beef heart. Oh, so, you're hearing restaurant work real time, folks.
We do that one. We have the brain ravioli with the truffles. And then we have the tuna offal dish. We'll start face. I'll be down in like 10 minutes.
Okay. Okay. Let's start them off with this, though?
Let's start them off with that, and then we'll fill in. Let's crush
it. Do you want me to add the tuna heart, the beef heart to our heart of this course?
Do we have enough bone marrow? Let's do vitello tonnato. Vitello tonnato. Let's do them at the same time, hot and cold next to each other. Can we do that?
Yeah.
Is that cool? We'll do that for the second one.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Freedom.
Wow, this is great. Okay. We've got to race through your life here, Chris. So your goal was to be an internationally known chef.
But then, you know, that's like an 18-year-old kid or 17-year-old kid in high school, and I just had no idea. Right. You know, like all I'd known is Emeril and Jacques and Julia.
So you watched TV.
Yeah, but this was pre-Emeril. Like, I knew Emeril because he was from Fall River, which was the next town over.
That's true. He's from Rhode Island.
He's Fall River, Mass.
Oh, Mass.
Right the way over.
Oh, right.
So I left Rhode Island, moved to Washington, D.C. to work for Mark Miller.
What? How did you know that?
I had his book. I had Coyote Cafe.
So you wanted to work with him?
Yeah, I sought him out. I mean, food anthropologist is pretty few and far between in the culinary world.
That's right.
So I went to work for Mark Miller, and I worked for Mark for about 2 years at mm-hmm. Red Sage. Mm-hmm. And from there, I went to, which, you know, Mark was really instrumental in teaching me about history. Mm-hmm. The one important, and I, every day, show up early, leave late, off the clock on both, mm-hmm. volunteered for every off-site event. I was fortunate enough to be, because I started doing that, he started dragging me all over the country to do events. I get to meet Jimmy Carter. I remember meeting Alice Waters for the first time in Atlanta because we were doing Habitat for Humanity. I remember that first event. It was mind-blowing for me to see all these people, meeting Jean-Louis Paladin through him, doing all these events. And
what's it like being a young chef, rubbing shoulders with all these big names? What did that do for you?
It was scary. Because you don't want to shit the bed. You don't want to let your boss down. So all your goal is to do it exactly the way Mark wanted it, or exactly the way your chef wanted it. It has to be perfect because it's going to shine on him, and then you're not going to ever get the opportunity to do this again.
So does it up your game?
It really makes you focus. It really makes you think about what's going on in your life and what you're doing at that time. You're not worried about, hey, is somebody going to get me a beer, or am I going to get to goof around later, or what's happening after? It's like, holy shit, Jean-Louis Paladin standing in front of me and I'm making his food right now. And this is not my food, but it is at this moment. And I have to make this right.
So how much did you grow with those kinds of experiences? And is that something that can be replicated if you don't do that?
You know, a
great master chef and then get in these situations where you're working with these other masters.
I think for me it was a huge eye-opener. You know, representing Mark Miller. It's Mark Miller.
He's awesome.
He's awesome. I mean, he has the best palate I've ever seen in my life. To this date, you know, he is a great mentor, he's a great teacher, but he really showed me history. Have the legs to stand on. Know where the food comes from first before you think you're going to set a trend and change the world. Because, to be quite honest, you don't know shit. And you learn every single day. Mark admits he learns every single day. So the moment one thinks that they know everything, they really truly know nothing. And that's what Mark taught me. And that's why cooking for these people, I really knew nothing. I knew nothing. All I was there to facilitate somebody's vision and to learn how to do it. What is it that makes this work? What is the flavor balance? Who am I serving? Why am I serving them this? And is it perfect? Would I serve this to my mother? Would I serve this to my grandmother? Am I proud of this? And every time I've done that, and every time I did that with Mark, it was an eye-opening experience. I remember being at an event with Mark, and it was actually, I'll never forget this, it was in Atlanta. And we were at the meal, Habitat for Humanity for Jimmy Carter. And there were stations. There were big stations. And we were serving a lot of people. And there was an Alice Waters station. And there was Mark and I. And there was another. And I remember there was a chef de cuisine of a restaurant that was pretty hammered, plating for his chef. And I kicked him off his station. I told him he's screwing up the dish. And Mark stepped in with me and we plated the dish together. And I remember that. I think I was maybe 21. And I was a prep cook. I was Mark Miller's prep cook. And I had the sand to tell this guy he was wasted and he needed to get out of his way.
So was Mark proud of you for doing that?
It was a little awkward later in the evening.
Yeah.
For everybody.
Yeah.
But that particular chef was speaking. So it was his food that was being represented. He wasn't there.
Oh, wow.
He was out speaking in the dining room. And he was being introduced for his course. And the food was not right. And I'll never forget that. Mark was like, okay, I got it. Boom. Mark jumped in and our chef de cuisine that was with us there jumped in. And we were putting up Mark's food and that food. The guy got all mouthy, and I mean, it was a pretty brazen move for a 21-year-old prep cook.
So where'd you go after Mark?
I went to Bob Kincaid, and I worked for Bob Kincaid, and which taught me volume, quality, and volume, and respect.
Was that at Kincaid's?
I was in Kincaid's in D.C. And then from there, I didn't know what to do, and my wife, my girlfriend at the time, and I talked and. We decided we were going to move to California. It was either New York or California.
Why California?
All the produce boxes said California. All the bottles of wine said California. So why the fuck not?
Really?
There's nothing. There was at that time, there was nothing growing in New York.
No, that's true.
You know, and I was racing bikes at that time, and I was like, I might as well just, let's go to California.
Motorbikes.
Bicycles.
Bicycles.
Yeah. So
where were you racing?
I was racing all in D.C. and Virginia and Maryland, all mountain bikes. So it was, I enjoyed riding my bike. It was my only head cleanse. So
California.
California was it. We moved out here 6 months later. No job, nothing. Came out here blind.
So where did you settle?
Well, she had been here, so I had no idea what I was walking into. All I knew was a hilly city. And we came, and my first job was that I was going to accept a job at China Moon. And Barbara Tropp became sick again, and she recommended I go somewhere else. So my first job was at One Market, and that wasn't a very long-lived stint. And then I ended up with Tracy Desjardins at Rubicon. And I was there for 2.5 years.
So Tracy's pretty classically, she spent time at Trois Grands. She was in France.
She was in France.
She was very classically trained, and she's, Hispanic. So I think you've got a little bit of everything going on there. But she's very, so what was that like? Because that was different than
Tracy came from Joaquim. So it was so it was a very different kitchen. I mean, Tracy nicknamed me. She said I talk too much. She called me Hollywood. She would push me really hard. Push me. Now, she's, we're great. We're like best of friends. Love her to death. She's the most, she's amazing.
So what was a woman's kitchen like? Did you notice a difference?
No.
That's interesting, because a lot of people say women have different kitchens, but here you...
She was just as hard or harder. Tracy was so tough, and she still is. I'm still petrified to cook for Tracy. Still. Makes me nervous. She always makes me nervous. Tracy makes me nervous. It's what it is. I just cooked for her 2 nights ago. Still makes me nervous. I'm like, checking in on her. You okay? Is everything all right? You like everything? It's like, it's...
How long did you stay there?
I was there longer than Tracy was at Rubicon's. The rate Tracy left to go open Jardinier. So I stayed there for 2.5 years.
So that was Drew Nieperant and...
Yep.
And Coppola.
Robin Williams,
So what was it like doing the movie star, Robin Williams? Did you...
I mean, I got to meet Bobcat Goldthwait. I got to meet Robin Williams. I'm a cyclist, so I would see Robin out riding. Really nice guy. But it wasn't about that. It was about the food,
And the wine.
And the wine with Larry Stone.
Yeah.
And at that point, I was looking for the next step.
How far up the food chain did you get in the kitchen?
I was a line cook.
Okay.
That's it. There was no moving up at that point. Mm-hmm. No moving up. It was this time that was stuck, and I didn't know what to do, and they were opening a restaurant on Martha's Vineyard called the Coach House, so I moved out there, lived on Martha's Vineyard for a year.
Who was opening?
Drew.
Okay.
So I moved to Martha's Vineyard to open the Coach House.
But you had come out here, so was that like a retreat?
Well, I didn't know. I didn't know if I wanted to go back home and end up in Boston. I missed New England.
Uh-huh.
So I went back, opened on a very small island that required a boat to get back and forth, 45 minutes each way. Stayed a year, went batshit crazy, and left.
Yeah,
and I came back here. I couldn't deal. We went to Tatiana and I went to France for a month. Mm-hmm. Came back, gave notice, and left a month later.
So then, when you came back here, you probably knew what you were getting into. What kind of restaurant were you looking for?
I came back to help open a restaurant. It was called Bellone.
He's with us.
So, I helped my friend Paul Ehrenstam open a restaurant called Bellone. It was a French brasserie, and that's what I came back for.
So how long were you there?
I was there for 2 years, plus years.
And what did you learn from that?
A lot.
Why?
It was a hard opening.
Was it about the opening, or was it about the...
It was about everything. I mean, it was about everything. It was Paul was a good friend, and we worked at Rubicon together. It was about the opening. It was about the experience of starting something from ground zero, and it was a management role in a small restaurant within a hotel that was not owned by the hotel. So it was a big learning curve, a lot of moving parts.
So the kinds of management things you were learning when you were a teaching assistant at Johnson & Wales, did it translate into a restaurant environment?
Sometimes it did, sometimes it didn't. Teaching environment is very different.
So were you happy in your work then?
In the restaurant?
Yeah. Like, were you happy saying I chose being a cook for my life? week's work? You were learning every day, but...
I wouldn't change what I've done. Sometimes I wish I had a little bit of my own time, but I wouldn't change any of it. I think I've made some really exceptional choices. Sometimes you learn from your biggest mistakes. You learn what not to do and what to do. I was at Bellone for 2.5 years. While I was there, I turned down a sous chef job with Jean-Louis Paladin.
And you were enamored with Jean-Louis, right? So how did you turn that down? Why?
I don't know.
Was it in Watergate?
No, it was at Napa.
Oh, Las Vegas?
Yeah.
In Napa?
That was the hardest thing I ever did.
You don't know why you turned it down?
I just moved here. Oh. I just moved back. I turned it down. I did an event with him at Staglin Vineyards. Then he called me to do Masters of Food and Wine at Highlands Inn, the original one, and I went and cooked with him and Michel Richard and all the big boys. And I was Jean-Louis' boy. I mean, I didn't get much further than an arm's reach. And I was with him for 4 days straight.
And that's when he offered you sous?
He offered me sous job, and I said no.
Do you regret it?
Some days, yes. Some days, no. I don't think it would have... I think it would have changed me and not made me who I am now. But...
How? You can't say that and not go...
I think it would have...
Would you be more French?
No, I don't think it would have been more French, but I think I would... been more... I'm glad I'm not super high-end.
I see.
And I think it would have driven me into that, and I am glad it didn't. But I loved... the insanity, the brilliance, the spontaneity, his insatiable love of the business, of fun, of conviviality. He brought the best out of everyone.
He did. He was incredible.
There'll only be one like him.
Yeah.
And that was the hardest thing I ever did. Still. That was the hardest choice I made.
So where did the Encanto awful... when did your voice start happening?
You know, I came... After Bellone, I went to the Michael Mina Group, and I helped open Nob Hill in Las Vegas, Redwood Park. I was helping at Aqua. And I'd helped them with so many things, and in 9 months, I just was fried. Because I helped them open 3 restaurants, and my hair was falling out. I was just fried. I was fried. I'd never worked that much in my life. I mean, I was going and going. I was living in a hotel and in Vegas and helped them with 2 projects there. And then I came back here and then I was doing Redwood Park and then I was at Aqua and I was fried. So I quit. I quit everything. I stopped cooking for 2 years.
And did what?
I raced mountain bikes professionally. I said, fuck you to everybody. And I didn't want to do anything else. I wanted to go ride my bike and smell fresh air and not care.
Where did you do that?
All over the world. I raced my bike in Canada and Europe, raced all throughout the United States. I needed a break, and I was very fortunate that my wife is cool and helped support me. If it wasn't for her, I wouldn't have been able to do it. I don't think I would have found who I am.
So how did you come back to cooking?
The chef of Bellone had gone to be the chef of Grand Cafe, and when I decided I needed to get back in the kitchen, I started working with him again. He gave me a position there.
So you're on the mountain bike. You're probably just so relieved the first month, 2 months, 6 months. Then you get it. How was your withdrawal from food? And then what was...
There was no withdrawal because I went from being highly hyper-focused on food to hyper-focused on being a competitive, high-end professional athlete. So I went from competing in the kitchen to competing against professional athletes. So I went... racing 24-hour mountain bike races solo all over the place. So, now I'm fortunate that a lot of those people are now my friends. Like, Keith Bontrager lives in Santa Cruz, makes Bontrager bike parts. He's one of our regulars. Bob Roll, the host of Tour de France, the commentator, he comes here now. He's one of our regulars. And I've been fortunate to meet all these people. And through those experiences, it's changed who I was. Made me find myself and find the direction of food I wanted to go.
So why did you stop mountain biking professionally?
Mountain biking professionally doesn't have a long term. For me, it didn't. I wasn't as advanced as those other guys. And, you know, I was in the kitchen. Kitchen was where I belonged.
So was your voice forming while you're...
Oh, yeah. There? I figured out what I wanted to do. I was working at farmers markets. That's how I was supporting myself when I wasn't out racing. You know, I was working for different farm stands. I was selling produce at the farmers markets, you know, cooking at home. I was just really trying to focus on who I was.
So where did your... We're going to run out of time. I want to find out where this whole... I mean, you have a very distinctive...
How did I get to where I am now?
Exactly. But
you wanted to compress that in too little. I mean,
no,
you're talking to a guy with a gift of fucking gab.
Yeah.
So there's no real easy answer to... When I started here 10 years ago, I wanted to be in a place that created conviviality in the spirit of Italian food. Okay? This was the perfect environment for it. One, we're not in Italy, so you're never going to be 100% replication of that. You could say you are, but that's a load of crap. You can't be 100% replication of what's in Italy because we don't have the same tasting basil. We don't have the same tasting tomato. Everything's different, okay? We're in an area of Italy called California, but this isn't Cali-Tal either. I looked at the peasant foods. They all embraced using everything. I went and did my first real animal harvest, and I saw how much was being thrown in the garbage can. And that was the game change. That was it. It was done.
So it wasn't another chef doing it, and you're going, wow, this is, I want to do this. It was really you seeing...
I went to harvest 3 goats for Easter the first year I was here. I harvested an adult goat and 2 kid goats, caprettos, to see what would be about 35 to 45% of the animal being thrown in a garbage can. Was a very hard thing to choke down. From that day on, I committed to not doing that.
So you then have to butcher your own
food. Yeah, I mean, too bad you weren't coming tomorrow. Right now I have 2 lambs in there. Tomorrow I'll have 2 200-pound pigs. I'll have 3 suckling pigs. Currently have 2 whole lambs and a suckling pig in there right now.
Okay.
So tomorrow I'll have 9 animals in this restaurant.
What do you do with your staff, and how do you butcher them?
My guy Hector and I butcher them, or Freedom and I does it. It's like, they're going to, it's just, we make it work.
And you use every part of it.
I use everything I can get my hands on. It's the best thing we can do. It's hard. It's not easy. And anybody says it's easy is full of shit. And it's a hard task. It's hard to make it work.
How did you learn what to do with it all? Where did you learn what to do?
Trial and error, reading books, eating.
Tell me how, and I told you, I talked to Mark Casey. And for you out there who don't know who Mark Casey is, he was known as Il Divino in Italy. He was the first 3-star Michelin chef. I told him about you using the muscle inside the 2 stomachs of a...
Oh,
cow.
Yeah. That I learned.
And doing a crudo with that. He can't wait to meet you, by the way.
But see, that was a technique that I learned from a chef from Japan, from Takashi in New York. The restaurant Takashi in New York. I had a dish of that there. Then I went to Japan a couple months later, had it again in Japan, and was mesmerized by it, tried to figure it out, started talking to him about where to source the product. He told me, and then I told him what I thought was the technique, and he said I was right. So if it wasn't for Takashi helping me, I wouldn't have been able to do it. And I think, listen, we're not out there by ourselves. Everybody else has knowledge. If we share it with each other, we're better for everything, right? So I can't take credit for that and say it's mine. I created it. The pairings that I do with it, yeah, that may be a little weird and that's mine. But that's it. Like, I do surf and turf with it. So I do lobster and raw stomach, beef stomach. So there's our beef, surf and turf. But that being said, gotta give credit where credit's due. It's a Japanese technique that Takashi from New York taught me. And I just manipulated it to fit into my genre of food. That's all I've done. So I'm like a technique thief. I go to other countries and I learn about the culture and the technique that they may work with organs. And how do I apply it to an Italian cooking techniques? Like, how do I bring it into the Italian vernacular of food? So I'm not recreating anything. I'm not creating anything new. I'm just borrowing techniques from all different cultures, and I'm reviving a lot of dead techniques from history. And I think being honest with everybody and telling the truth of what it is and who I am, I'm very comfortable with that. I'm not reinventing the wheel. And I think that's really important, because too many people get on this tirade of like, hey man, check out this cool new thing I done. I created something new. It's really few and far between that somebody does create something totally new.
Why did you go on MasterChef?
I went on Top Chef Masters because I wanted to raise awareness for Michael J. Fox and the Parkinson's.
And how did you get involved with Michael J. Fox and Parkinson's?
So the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research is a very special organization. 93 cents of every dollar goes towards research. And that, to me, was a big deal. But also, my uncle died of Parkinson's. He had it for 25 years. Fergus Henderson, my friend, has Parkinson's. I have some of my friend's parents have Parkinson's. It's a very powerful thing. And you're held captive. And I felt that win or lose, go there, make a lot of noise for Michael J. Fox Foundation. Fine, go home a few days, who cares? I made a lot of noise. Maybe everybody pays attention and listens.
And you made a lot of money.
In the end, I ended up making a lot of money.
But for them.
For them. I mean, I didn't make a red cent, which I'm fine with.
Yeah.
We made $141,000 for the Michael J. Fox Foundation. And through Google, the founder of Google doubled that donation.
Oh.
So it became $282,000.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful.
So, I mean, I did it for them. I did it for my friend's parents. I did it for Fergus. I did it for my Uncle John. You know, what did I get out of it? I got to have fun and compete again. I got to live my bike racing all over again.
You're competitive.
I'm competitive. That's who I am.
All right. Who's your ideal diner in El Canto? And what do you want them to feel when they leave?
I want them to feel happy. I don't, you know, ideal diner? I don't know. One who trusts me.
Ooh. And you have to, when you hear things like pulverized tuna heart.
Yeah, but I mean, you got to trust people. You come to a restaurant because you trust somebody. At least I hope so.
That's true. Actually, Chef Alain Seyak says to the students, you do the most important thing. You are so intimate with your diner because from your hands you make something they put in their body.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and it is true. If you don't trust your chef, get out of the
restaurant.
Well,
it makes it a different game.
Right. So, there are young chefs out there who listen to this program. And I hear some it runs at noon on Wednesdays on Heritage Radio Network.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear some kitchens play it in the kitchen.
Oh, wow.
Working. What do you have to say to young chefs out there? Ones that are out of cooking school, maybe they're in cooking school and they're working, or young ones that are just like 2-3 years into the profession?
I think the mistakes I learned from was, one, shut up. Two, listen. Don't talk back. Just say yes and listen to the information that's being given to you. It's not personal. It's business. And be prepared. Show up early. Don't show up at the time of your shift and then get dressed. Be ready when you're supposed to be punched in. Show up with a notebook. Sharp knives, a peeler, a paring knife. Be prepared. Be a professional. A plumber doesn't show up to the job without the tools. Why should you?
Thank you.
I mean, I'm not asking for the world, you know? If you're going to send a resume in, get the correct spelling of the word restaurant. That's a really big deal. Spell the chef's name right, name of the restaurant. Focus. It doesn't need to be that hard.
Thank you. This has been wonderful.
I mean, it's really not that big of a deal. It's just
it is
the basics.
It is the basics. You do it. You do the basics and the awful.
I think the most important thing is have common sense.
Common sense.
It goes a long way. Mm-hmm. If the blender's on, don't stick a metal utensil in it. It's pretty basic. That's just one. I'm gonna throw you guys that one as a bone. Just don't put a metal spoon in the blender when it's on.
All right. I think on that, we can say thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Chef's Story, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.